Bitcoiner when it comes to, you know, the fundamentals of Bitcoin, monetary properties, and especially, you know, his book just came out. It's called Money Dethroned, A Historical Journey. You should definitely check out also his Twitter threads, Twitter posts. And yeah, let me know what you think afterwards. I'm really looking forward to that talk. And it's really important for the sake of education, for the sake of comprehension to, you know, before we go into action, before we, you know, expect people to go into action and carry with us this monetary evolution, it's the understanding, you know, the learning out of history that, you know, it's nothing new. Debasement of money, inflation, you know, the fucking up the money is not something new. It's been going on for such a long with its metallurgy, metal money or whatever, paper money. Every culture, every you know, historical event, you can go back. And so I think the art and the challenge is to learn out of this and understand, you know, how is inflation, how is debasement really created? And yeah, so let me know what you think afterwards and write me an email to hello@thetotalconnect.com or follow me on Twitter, subscribe, share, follow. And thanks so much for support and for listening. And without further ado, this is my talk with Emil Sundstedt. Hey, Emil, how are you doing? Hey. Thank you so much for coming to my show again.
Thank you very much, Kevin, for inviting me again. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's always great to have you because you have really profound knowledge. You just published your new book. Congratulations to that. It's called, I love the title, Money Dethroned. A Historical Journey. So you can get it on Amazon, right?
On Amazon, that's correct, as an ebook or as a paperback.
Yeah, there it is. Right now it's an Kindle version, but the paper version is going to come, the print version?
The paper version is there, so you have to click on my name there. They will link automatically in the future, but I don't know.
Yeah,
so there you go.
Wonderful. So listen, first of all, just an anecdote. Somebody on Twitter, I guess you know him by his Twitter handle, Arbidu or Abidau, Arbidu.
Yeah, I follow him.
Yeah, so it's so funny. He published, he tweeted the new books of Ben Bernanke. you know, I mean, it's meant, of course, cynical, but he, 2017, he published Bernanke's book, The Courage to Act. Mm-hmm. 2019, Bernanke's book, Firefighting, The Financial Crisis and Its Lessons, published. And then in 2020 now, Bernanke's book, First Responders, Inside the U.S. Strategy for Fighting a Global Financial Crisis. I mean,
it's a real hero, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, isn't it funny? The very same people, the very same entities who commit arson are put into charge of the one of the most fundamental decision-making processes when it comes to money. Well, you know, it's like, you know, giving the arsonists
yeah, and you know, likely they don't see themselves, of course, as arsonists. They see themselves as saviors, because many of these mainstream economists see themselves as better. They need to fix stuff that isn't broken. That's their shtick.
So, Emil, let's have a first, you know, like a zoom out, have a bigger picture. What are you trying to make your readers, your potential readers, everybody that's following you or reading your books, trying to make them understand, comprehend with your book?
So the book, Money Dethroned, it's, as you hear, it's about money. And as Bitcoiners, we talk about money all the time. And I was writing all these articles last year about, they're called Tales of Soft Money. And they follow all these examples of primitive monies that once were money, but and now we can't use them as money anymore. So they got demonetized or dethroned, if you will. I started out with all these articles, and after a while, I had dinner with a friend in the city, and we were talking about money, about Bitcoin. He's not a Bitcoiner, but he's interested in money. And he said, yeah, you should write a book about it. And I decided, yeah, why not? I have a lot of articles, I have a lot of material. So why not? It's a good way to consolidate all the knowledge in one place. So what I did with Money Dethroned half of the book is more or less about these instances of primitive monies. And I think by now, Bitcoiners are rather good at understanding, for example, the properties of hardness, stock to flow ratios, what properties makes money good, what makes money bad. So this first half of the book, I think most Bitcoiners are really, really good at understanding the dynamics of place, the Austrian economics, how many monies become one after a while, relative saleableness and all this. But one thing that was rather new for me, of what I thought about, and that I added in the second half of the book that we can go to already, it's the it deals with the basements and general tinkering of money. And this, I think, is the next step for many people involved with Bitcoin or that likes to think about money. This is the next step to think about in terms of how to defend Bitcoin's hardness or how to think about money in general, because we all understand that money will have in the end, you know, infinite stock to flow. That's great. What I did in the second half of Money Dethroned is that I started with one real example of it's a Tunisian merchant in 14th century North Africa. He's on this journey east towards Mecca. He's very rich. He is carrying a lot of gold dinars. And due to the summer heat, he sadly passes away there on the journey. So he left his gold dinars to a friend in the caravan. The Tunisian government, the authorities, they heard about this event. So they quickly confiscated all the gold from this merchant. So no gold ever reached his descendants in Tunis. So I think this is a good example of, even though he had the hardest money in the world, gold, it didn't help him in the end when it was confiscated. So this dynamic, it's what I'm trying to emphasize in the second half of the book, that even though Bitcoin is extremely hard, it will soon be harder than gold. We have to continue to think about how to defend the hardness. And this example with the Tunisian merchant, it's only one example. You have, of course, much more common examples of powerful states debasing the money. They are putting silver in the gold coins. They put copper in the silver coins. They shrink the size, they shrink the weight, they change the shapes of the money, they change the face values of the money and all this. And bear in mind that this is all done on, for example, gold, world's hardest money. So with the powerful states, they can still exercise considerable harm to people that hold hard money. And so this is what makes the second part of the book very relevant for Bitcoin, in my opinion, that it teaches us all these various examples how gold was attacked. And we can extrapolate that and apply it to Bitcoin. Like, how can we resist similar attacks to Bitcoin?
But is it possible? Let me ask you, is it really, can you extrapolate it? Can you really compare, you know, the historical hardness of gold and the risks and the, you know, didn't want to interrupt your flow, you know, but is it on the same level? I mean,
I think it's possible for various reasons. For example, debasements. Debasements is akin to adding more supply to the money. With Bitcoin, what I was going to come to, our best defense with Bitcoin and our best defense of Bitcoin's hardness is the ability to run full nodes. Mm-hmm. This is something that many are emphasizing on Twitter, for example, and I think it's generally understated. People tend to focus more on these stock to flow models, for example, and it's very nice, of course, to have a really high stock to flow, and I love it as well. But we have to be able to very simply run full nodes. They have to fit in a laptop, for example, because with a full node, we can assess Bitcoin every day. We can see that no one has exercised debasement on it. We can see that no one exercised various tinkering on Bitcoin, and we can keep our Bitcoin pure by always running a full node, so we know which economic rules we are running or we adhere to.
And directly self-validating every transaction, right? And
yeah,
seeing it with your own eyes, right?
Exactly. So this is, I think it's a valid comparison to gold, because gold was, it was very costly to assess. If you have, if you're a merchant and you are getting, you receive a gold coin, it was not always the case that they even had the technology to judge how much gold is really in this coin. The basements were often exercised with, for example, 1, 2, 3% silver content added every time. And you can't see such a small gradual shift in the basement. So people were constantly defrauded by the authorities, while we who run Bitcoin full nodes, we can't be constantly defrauded because we validate everything. So in a sense, Bitcoin will be harder than gold, but it is already much easier to assess than gold. So we are already escaping a lot of costs that these guys using gold and silver, they couldn't escape these costs. And for me, it was very interesting to kind of stumble upon the next step. If you realize Bitcoin is hard, you move on to the next step and realize that, yeah, Bitcoin is hard and we can enforce the economic rules ourselves. We can always assess the quality of the Bitcoin that we own.
You know what's fascinating with your explanations and historical analysis is that it's a repetitive debasement. It's like, you know, I had a teacher once, I had an English and historical teacher in school, and he said it would be too good to be true if we as humanity or people, you know, could learn something out of history. I mean, I don't literally agree with him, but I do understand, I understood his point he was trying to make. But when you explain all these debasements that have been going on for such a long time, you know, like even thousands of years, at least hundreds of years and hundreds and hundreds of years, is that it you can find it in literally in every culture, right?
Yeah. You can find it in almost everywhere, these debasements, and they come in various shapes and forms also. So they're not, you know, naively, you would think that the debasements, it's just an order from the authorities, hand in the silver, we're going to give you back the same amount of coins, but you will get 5% less silver content, for example. But the way they did the debasements, they came in so many shapes and forms. And it can be good to know all of this, you know, that they changed the sizes. Even happy events, they make into something bad. Like, for example, one example in my book is when the Byzantine army reconquers their capital, Constantinople. Of course, this has to be celebrated, and the emperor want to issue new coins to celebrate this. And what does he do with the new coin? He debases them. So the populace just gives him the money. He takes it. He takes a lot of gold from it, and then he restamps the money and give it back. So they have tried all kinds of trickery to get money, and it always has worked. But it doesn't work anymore. Bitcoin is resisting this seigniorage, the difference between the cost to produce the money and the value of the money. So suddenly the state can't put the tax in the seigniorage anymore. It can shift the tax towards other. It can increase the, for example, sales tax or income tax or corporate tax, which is pretty popular these days to be angry about corporations. But it can't put the tax on the money anymore with Bitcoin, which I see as a big win.
Right. So can we talk about, it's really, really important to understand the Austrian economical perspectives and the monetary properties, what makes a money, what are really good monetary properties. But when we talk about the structures that we have been born into for at least 100 years now with the central banks, do you want to comment a little bit about this, the legitimacy of the central bank? I know it's not part of your book, I get that, but I always come to the same conclusion. It's like, where does the central bank, or the central bank of all central banks, the bank for international settlements, and the total centralized structures that surround it, the puppets, bureaucrats, technocrats, agents, decision makers, where do they derive their legitimacy?
But I don't think they don't have legitimacy. They have power because mm-hmm. yeah, because they have power. And one thing, my book is written, the historical Jarne is about medieval events. It's often about medieval historical accounts. What the emperors and kings and sultans back then were doing with money, it was always a bit difficult for them. They had to lure people to give the gold and silver so that they could debase it. In some really harsh rulers, they forced people to come with the precious metal. Otherwise, you would get killed. But in general, it was difficult. And nowadays, with the central banks, it's not even difficult anymore. They have all the power. So if they want to debase, they will debase. So in a sense, it's even worse today than it was during the worst times in the Middle Ages. So this is an interesting situation. And I think people are generally accept the central bank because these really disastrous events, they don't come super often. They come often enough, but not super often. So people kind of choose not to see the negative effects, but when they do embark on debasements, or as we now call money printing, which is the same thing, it's really, really bad for the societies. And we have so many examples of this that I'm even interested in writing a second money dethroned about the paper experiments instead. Because they are, in a sense, even worse than the metallic debasements and the metallic tinkering that people that they were doing before. So these paper experiments, I've been writing about two of them in my Tales of Soft Money. One was the Yon Law I think he started in the end of the 17th century, can be. Yeah, Yon Law, he was reorganizing the French monetary system. And then 100 years after, or approximately 100 years after, you have the Assignat experiment, where they also managed to destroy the whole economy of France, and people were put in abject poverty and starvation, and in the end, you know, guillotines. So I have written about two of these examples of paper money and central banks making a complete mess. So it would be rather interesting to continue there to see how many good examples can we find of actual total disaster of such paper money, because I think you can really screw up an economy much, much faster with central banks and paper money than you could as a medieval monarch just trying to get some seigniorage from silver and gold. But back to your question, I don't see any legitimacy. It's I don't see it.
While knowing, you know, I mean, I know I'm repeating myself a little sometimes, but it's so unbelievable when you know, when you understand that all the members of the Bankers National Assembly, all central banks, they are literally untouchable, politically untouchable, legally not liable, and criminally immune. And this is what I just, I wish, we could, better make people comprehend, or I don't know, visualize. The problem, I think, also is not only our generation, but our past generation, our parents and grandparents, they don't even know, they or didn't know what it was like or what it could have been like on a hard money basis, with it the gold standard. So sometimes I wonder, or maybe even Safed and Amous wrote about this, like how could have, artists like whoever, Michelangelo or like lived for such a long time. I mean, except maybe you married someone rich or you inherited a lot of money. But I think a couple of hundred years ago, people were still able to save money to keep purchasing power. Are we moving towards that again?
Yeah, with Bitcoin, yes. With fiat money, no. You can't really save. I don't know many people that save a lot of money in the state currencies. Mm-hmm. It's better to invest it, even if, let's say, you don't know about Bitcoin, then it's even then better to just invest it on the stock market or buy a slightly more expensive property or whatever, because the annual added money production, it's not worth having just storing your wealth that way. I want to bring up one thing. You talked about the central banks. One thing that I think people underestimate is also that the dangers posing from central banks, it doesn't always come from, you know, decisions by authority that tells the central bank to print money. This is always a big danger, of course. We have certain such, you know, feelings in Turkey where, for example, Erdogan can put pressure on the central bank to change the interest rate or increase the money production and such stuff. And in history, there's been other examples of where the order comes, print more money, we need the money. Mm-hmm. But one underappreciated danger, I think, is that the economists that work in central banks, many of their models, their mental models are wrong. So they are perceiving sometimes a scarcity of money and an abundance of money. So I have read certain excerpts from the German central bank in the 1920s, before the hyperinflation, and the arguments they were putting forward, why they were printing money that led to hyperinflation. They were so extremely similar to many arguments, to many false arguments that you see today about money, that there is not enough money in circulation, or there's not enough money to chase all the products and services. It's kind of weird Keynesian economic thinking that leads these central banks to cause monetary disaster despite not getting an order from above, print more money. Because, you know, when the order comes from above, print more money, that of course they can understand that this will end in disaster, but we have a dictator and he tells us to do it. So I see a danger also in central banks causing monetary disaster just by their own incompetence also, not by any that they want to cause a disaster. So Bitcoin fixes that as well. It fixes the threat that any party comes to power and orders the printing presses to go hot. And it also fixes their ability to, because they're incompetent, these central bankers, that they print because they're incompetent and that they think that it spurs the economy on or whatever.
Now, can we make a differentiation now whether, you know, however they inflate the money or, you know, debase the money, whether it's literally printing money out of thin air or creating centralized digital fiat money or fractional reserve banking? Do you want to like make a differentiation, like how they create?
In general,
maybe in connection with the, you know, with this trend of the central banks with the intention to create a central bank digital currencies.
Mm-hmm. No, the central bank, when you say central bank digital currencies, do you mean their current the cryptocurrency experiments that they're pursuing, or do you mean just in general? Okay.
For example, like China now, you know, talk about, or I mean, it's at the end of the day, it's centralized. It's a centralized digital ledger.
Exactly. So it's just it's just a mirage. It's a waste of time from their part because they already have centralized money and they can already manage the money. So if they create these fake cryptocurrencies, and they, I think Sweden is pursuing such a project, for example, e-krona, they will still be in power to change it. They can change the supply, they can censor transactions and so on. And since the monetary systems are already digitalized, I don't see a point, but on the other hand, I haven't researched the subject because it doesn't interest me. I don't see that they can. For me, it's just the same kind of state currency as usual. It was already digitized before and it will be digitized. And if they want to call it cryptocurrency, that's fine, but it will not be like Bitcoin, of course.
Mm-hmm. What about the how strong is the circulation of paper money or cash in your country? Like, because there are some countries, you know, that people are really, adamantly, totally keen on using still, you know, cash, like Germany, I think one of the few countries that there's a high circulation. What about in your country, in Sweden?
No, cash is very uncommon. People don't use cash. Most people have an app, it's called Swish. You can Swish money to each other and it settles instantly, so it's rather good that way. And when you pay in the stores and so on, people don't use paper money. there was some law coming recently that the banks are they're forced to provide paper currency to especially the older part of the population that wants it. But the general trend has for a long time been to go digitized. Mm-hmm. And for me, I don't mind. I see the structural problem, of course. It is much easier for future totalitarian forces to control the economy if everything is digitized, to shut down certain money channels, whatever. But now we have Bitcoin as well, so I use my Visa card happily. I don't care. I have Bitcoin also, so.
Right. Where do you think is this process going with negative rate interest policy and everything is going on globally right now? Do you see like an end? how long can they blow up this balloon?
You know, I have focused lately now on the metallic debasements and the primitive monies. So I wouldn't consider myself an expert on the modern system enough to have a strong opinion on that. I think it looks super weird, of course, with negative interest rates. There's something wrong, obviously. At the same time, the monetary system now, it's so complicated. So it takes a lot of time to really become an expert in it. I wish I could research more about it, and maybe I will in the future. But right now, I just stay away from that. I don't dabble with it investment-wise or anything. I keep the Bitcoin, and I don't have any trust in that these guys know what they are doing when they are putting negative interest rates and whatever, because their economic models are flawed from the very beginning. So I think they for sure will screw up in one way or another.
So Emil, what do you think? Why do you think a lot of I call them old school macro investors, or you know, from the old traditional finance world? I mean, they're getting it. So, I think gradually, it's slowly but gradually they're getting it. But what do you think are the main reasons, or the obstacles, or bias, or what are the reasons that they're still extremely? I mean, it's beyond conservative. It's just doesn't mm-hmm. like even Ray Dalio. You know, people like Warren Buffett, but reasonable macro investors. Do you have the feeling they're opening up for Bitcoin?
I think they're slowly opening up. I do, but I think the general conservatism stems mainly from the economic education, which tells that state money is we only learn about state money, and you never discuss free market money in the universities, and inflation is seen as something good in university. You learn about it. If you increase the inflation, the unemployment reaches zero in then all these flawed models. But I also think it's a heuristic that anything new, these old conservative managers, they might have seen a lot of this economic tinkering and experimentation before, which has failed. And they have just a heuristic that, no, I don't want to be a part of that. I have seen such things fail before. This time is different thinking, or we have found a new solution to the world's ills. And like they are very skeptical against this kind of revolutionary solutions. And I think, as with many things, if they just studied more, if they studied the fundamentals, then of course they warm up to Bitcoin, because the fundamentals are really good. It's not based on hope. Bitcoin will only survive if the fundamentals are very good. I think we'll see that they will gradually embrace Bitcoin more and more. Maybe start to dabble a little bit and save through vehicles like exchange-traded notes and various instruments on the exchanges. And in the end, who knows, maybe more and more will buy real Bitcoin as well. But it takes time. I remember I was very skeptical the first time I heard about it. It was in the middle of my education in university. Mm-hmm. I saw this astronomical rise and then the crash because Mt. Gox got hacked. And I was thinking, what idiots, they have money that can be hacked. But then when you read about Bitcoin, you understand that back then people didn't even understand the distinction between an exchange getting hacked and the Bitcoin code base getting hacked.
Mm-hmm.
So exactly. I understand that people are skeptical, but this kind of monetization process, that usually takes time. The same with demonetization processes. Like many monies that I was writing about in Money Dethroned, it took hundreds of years for them to be dethroned, even though they were worthless as money. Like you have the glass beads in Western Africa, for example. One bead was actually worth its weight in gold
mm-hmm.
for a long time. It took many, many years and many ships full of beads to actually cause them to be demonetized in them.
And so, Emil, didn't it take like hundreds of years till people were conditioned, or you know, had to be conditioned to accept paper money instead of hard money, whatever hard money, you know, would it be silver, gold, or wasn't that like a gradual thing? Like people literally had to be convinced of, like, this is sort of in lieu of, you know.
I think so. As I said, I haven't started studying the period in detail yet. What mm-hmm. happened when, because my book ends with gold. Gold emerged victorious as money. So the next step, which you brings up now, it's obviously that to secure the gold, you don't want to keep it at your home at all times, especially when you're out traveling. So you hand it in to goldsmiths who have safe vaults, for example, and they give you a receipt that you have the gold at them. And from there, the paper money revolution started, you can argue. Paper represented the gold in the beginning, and then it, over time, it became disconnected, or a note did no longer represent the same amount of gold in the vault, because you did not have control over your physical gold. Yeah. But it was a natural result stemming from the properties of gold, that you can't safely store it yourself. And this is something that Bitcoin deals with as well. If you have your full node, you have a hardware wallet, for example, especially if you diversify with the hardware wallets, you can consider yourself very safe. You don't have to hand in your Bitcoin to anyone else.
Right. And additionally, you know, with all the security measures like multi-sig and So I want to ask you to wrap this up. You've heard of Jack Mallers' Strike development or app or whatever he just released, sort of as a beta or whatever phase. And, you know, it could literally red pill a lot of people without it having even the people, you know, average person think about Bitcoin. If they want to pay with fiat, they can go to the merchant, and the merchant, if they, let's say the merchant has a BTC pay server, and all it needs is the app, is of course, again, because, you know, it comes to, you know, to the, we need to talk about custody and surveillance then, but it is connected to a bank account, to debit card.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm trying to say is, can we put this whole shitcoinery attack discussions to rest? Because, you know, it's like, oh, Bitcoin is not a payment technology. And then, you know, the Bitcoin realists or maximalists say, oh, it's a savings technology. So maybe it has a purpose why it takes this time, it takes this gradual process to make it from a store of value or savings technology to a medium of exchange or payment technology. What does it do to the whole ecosystem, to the whole, you know, Bitcoin space?
Mm-hmm. I haven't checked in detail Jack's work on this. I have listened to him before. I really like what he's doing, but I will check out his latest software. But one thing that I like to view the Lightning Network applications in the framework of what I'm doing with Austrian economics, hard money, and so on. We have talked about saleableness and saleability. If many people use Bitcoin, layer one, you know, the fees rise astronomically, it's very difficult to use it with low cost. So this is an example of where saleableness of Bitcoin decreases when everyone is using it a lot. So what then Lightning Network is doing, it's that it offsets this decrease in saleableness. So if guys like Jack are pushing out really great solutions, it helps Bitcoin extraordinarily much, because it increases again the saleableness of Bitcoin. It lowers the cost of transacting with Bitcoin. So if the cost decreases, it will be used more for, you know, payments, transactions in the future. If the costs are high, people choose to, they choose not to buy frivolous things with Bitcoin. They choose to just save it instead. So I'm pretty optimistic about Lightning Network and that it increases, it will increase the number of transactions, possible transactions quite considerably, and that itself increases the saleableness of Bitcoin. So it's really good from even from an Austrian economist point of view.
Right. I just find it, you know, if we could just find a solution to the problem of this on and off ramp, because yeah, I mean, if the Strike app of Jack Mallers is still connected, right? It's connected to the fiat world. So what kind of technical regulatory obstacles there is, I don't know. So we shall see. But at least, you know, people, they can pay in fiat. They don't, you know, they don't have to go to 17 steps and set up a wallet, do this and do that. And I mean, it's crazy. It's overwhelming. So, but it's good for the merchant. I mean, it's the in between process, you know, how do we get rid of this, you know, fiat ramp on and off?
Exactly. It's good that new people can try out than Bitcoin. They will learn more about Bitcoin and so on. And these things, even if they're connected to the fiat system, it means that it is a central point of failure if the state gets very aggressive in the future. But, you know, meanwhile, I don't have anything against making such processes easier. Now, for example, an ETF is one example of the state in the future can shut it down, of course, if they want to. But meanwhile, it can give people a lot of utility to be able to easily funnel some money into an ETF, for example. So even though various developments are connected to the old monetary system, if you will, it doesn't make them bad. I'm not an extremist in the sense that we shouldn't touch the old system, or we should all I don't know how to best explain it. Like it is okay to use these custodial versions if you do it properly, if you don't put all your savings there, for example, and if you do it with care, if you judge which company is providing the custody. So that's totally fine. I can take one example. Here in Sweden, we have there's tax benefits to allocate some resources to Bitcoin through an exchange-traded note. You pay virtually no tax, even if it goes up in value. So then it's a trade-off. Either I have better security and better risk management if I keep the Bitcoin myself, or I entrust the issuer of the exchange-traded notes that they will handle it with multisigs and so on, that they hire good consultants, and that I don't pay tax when it goes up. So it's a trade-off. You don't have to choose either or, I think.
Right. So final question, Emil, what do you think could be, and besides, you know, the halvings coming next, whatever, April, May 2020, and then the halving after that, 2024. Are there any other, you know, events, macroeconomical or unexpected things that could happen that would, you know, usher into a blossoming of Bitcoin, make it really like unexpectedly go to, you know, liquidity and market cap of trillions?
You know, I don't know about blossoming, but for sure I want to see the effects that the halving have. It will be super interesting, especially since everyone wants to debate it on Twitter. But I also want to see how Bitcoin reacts to a financial crisis, because we haven't really seen it. I have some friends who have, they don't own Bitcoin, and they have been rather skeptical because they think Bitcoin will crash in the future if there is a crisis. Whatever it will be in the next crisis, of course, it's nothing that you should hope for, that economies are they're destroyed. But I want to see what happens, what the Bitcoin price will turn out to be.
Right.
That will be an interesting add the information.
Fascinating, Edo. So I can only call upon my listeners. Your book is now available on Amazon. Do you, are there any resources or links or anything you want to direct my listeners to?
They can go to Twitter, follow me. I'm Besant Denier, or just search for Emil Sandstedt. I guess you can put some link in also. They will find a pinned thread where they can find my book. And as I said in this talk, my book is about, it's about the emergence of money, and it's about primitive money, and then about metallic money, and all the kinds of screw-ups that were imposed on all these monies. So I think it's a historical journey, as it's called in the title, but I still think it's relevant for Bitcoiners to understand what has happened to money historically. Not only the shitty fiat experiments that we have seen failed over and over, but I also think it's kind of important to understand why even hard silver and gold got, people owning hard silver and gold got fleeced historically, because it can help us resist the state in the future.
Yeah. I find it fundamentally important to understand this pattern that you can constantly see, you know, and I think it's time to really comprehend and learn and really take action because of those consequences that we've learned out of those. So, yeah. So thanks so much, Emil, for sharing your knowledge, and glad.
Thank you, Kevin.
Oh, by the way, are you going to be in Vietnam, in Hanoi? You would be a perfect fit for this conference.
It's Eric's conference,
Eric Bosco, yeah.
I will follow. I hope they have a live stream or something. It will be really interesting.
Yeah, I'm going to do a series of interviews with all the speakers. Going to be a great speaker. So you would, you know, make a really a perfect complementary addition to this whole. It's, you know, basically fundamentally, it's about economical, aspects of Bitcoin. And technical, maybe to a limited degree. So, yeah, thanks so much, and hope to get you back soon.
Yeah, thank you so much, Kevin, and I would love to be back another time in the future.
All right,
take care.
Bye-bye. All right, what do you guys think? Really enjoyed, I always enjoyed my talks with Emil Sandstedt, so make sure you check out his book or purchase it, support his work. His website is bdratings.org, or follow him on Twitter, Besant Denier. This is his Twitter handle. I'm going to put this all in show notes, and Money Dethroned, the Historical Journey. All right. I would really appreciate if you leave me a positive review, share it, like it, review it, retweet it, whatever you do, you support me in any shape or form. And I would also really welcome ethical sponsors, because I want to go write, you know, personal face-to-face talks. I want to go to the conferences or go to those countries where these events or the experts and the Bitcoiners are, you know, giving speeches or whatever, or doing talks, presentations, so I can deliver your high-quality content, interviews and shows. And yeah, and thank you so much again for everything, and talk to you soon. Bye. Total Bitcoin.